Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on symptom management.
Welcome. We're here to talk with you about delirium management. I'm Natalie Jacobowski.
And I'm Frank Ferris. Our goal in talking about delirium management is going to start talking about how do we prevent delirium as best possible. And then we're going to talk about situations where it's potentially reversible or irreversible. We're going to talk about special situations in the intensive care unit when patients are delirious. And finally, a little bit about delirium with dementia and Parkinson's disease. But first, let's start off with thinking about ourselves. How long would you like to enjoy delirium for? Natalie, what about you?
Not very long.
And I'm with you. I actually don't want delirium if I can avoid it. I'd rather you prevent it. Could you do that?
I think that's a great point.
And then manage it quickly. Maybe a few minutes or a few hours at maximum. Each one of us needs to think about how quickly we recognize it. And you talked yesterday about hypoactive deliriums are really under-recognized, didn't you?
That's true. We did.
And the bottom line is we need to be careful about recognizing it and then managing it.
And so as we talk about managing delirium, it takes us back to what we talked about the pathophysiology. As you recall, there are many neurotransmitters that are involved. And as you can see as a reminder here, it's a balance of those neurotransmitters, having sometimes too much or too little. And also, we want to remember the many causes of delirium, and that part of our path of treating delirium is to treat the underlying cause. So we want to remember those common causes that we see in our palliative care patients.
And can we prevent it? A lovely study done by Sharon Inouye and her team. 852 patients all over the age of 70 admitted to a medicine service, and they focused on good non-pharmacological interventions to try to prevent it, making sure people were oriented, active, able to get them out and mobilize them, making sure they had good sleep, their eyeglasses, their hearing aids, and well hydrated. Really simple measures that we can do in every setting where we provide care. And what happened? Patients in the treatment group got far fewer episodes of delirium. You can see 62 patients compared to 90 in the standard treatment group. Shorter duration as well. In fact, significant. And the follow-up study showed an 89% reduction in the risk of delirium. Isn't this worth putting into practice in all of our settings? I certainly think so, don't you?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I'd like to start us out by setting a frame for how we think about the management of delirium. When we think about management, I'd like this to be the frame that we think about for all of our patients. First thing that comes to mind should always be, can we treat the cause? We also want to keep high on that list, maintaining that we ensure safety for our patient as well as for the staff. Following close behind that is addressing the environment, as the environment, as we noted previously, can help treat delirium by using non-pharmacologic measures. Then, we want to manage in our palliative patients by thinking about potential reversibility as well as the goals of care. To highlight that a bit further, I want us to think about it as a bit of a decision tree. On that tree, you have potentially reversible delirium that we'll talk about in more detail as we continue. And then we'll also talk in more detail about irreversible delirium. And I think about three broad categories for this. I think about the dying patient, where the dying process is our cause of delirium that we cannot reverse, and we treat the symptoms. I think about the patient where the goals of care are not consistent with reversing the cause of delirium, such as the patient with end-stage renal disease who decides to no longer continue on dialysis, and their uremia is the cause of delirium, yet not something they want to continue to treat. And then I think about when the treatment of the cause is unsuccessful, and the focus becomes treating the symptoms. So how do you approach delirium when it's potentially reversible? Let's think about it, thinking about that decision tree and the potentially reversible cases. And let's frame it in a case to help give us some context. Think about a 52-year-old lady who comes in through the emergency room, has advanced colon cancer with liver metastases, presents with neutropenic fever and sepsis. She's admitted to the ICU, placed on antibiotics and positive pressure ventilation with BiPAP. While there, she has significant agitation and anxiety, for which the team gives her as-needed lorazepam. As they notice she's trying to pull off her BiPAP mask, and her family notes that she's confused and is saying that the nurses are not actually nurses who are trying to help her and is afraid of the people who are there in the hospital. So let's think about how we approach helping this woman and the team caring for her. First approach is treating the cause by looking at a diagnostic workup, which the ICU is undertaking looking at her infection. As we think about our palliative patients, when we consider this, we think about the risks, benefits, and burdens of that. For her, she's getting treated for her infection, getting positive pressure ventilation. For a patient with goals that are clearly curative, they continue forward. For our patients with less clear goals, we might talk about time-limited therapeutic trials of interventions to see if that underlying cause of delirium might be able to improve. We also have benefit of using objective measures to track all of these symptoms, like our delirium screening tools we talked about earlier, to watch for improvement in those delirium symptoms. As we think about helping this woman, we're going to think about what we talked about at the beginning of this talk, that there are non-pharmacologic interventions that have been shown to significantly improve delirium. We want to help her sleep hygiene, promote day and night, even in the ICU environment, where, as we know, it's so difficult to create a normal, typical schedule. But we want to try to encourage blinds up during the day, room dark at night, promote familiar people at bedside, encourage a sense of routine, even in the ICU, and promote physical activity and mobility out of bed as much as possible, along with several other suggestions we can provide to the teams. When it comes to the pharmacological management of delirium, there are a few key points to keep in mind before we discuss it in more detail. There are no medications specifically approved for this purpose from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Until 2016, there were no published double-blind randomized placebo-controlled trials that studied this, and no consensus amongst medical specialists about medication choices, which, as you've probably recognized when you attempt to treat patients with delirium, leads to a challenge when everybody has a little bit of a different approach. So, as we walk down this path, we have a patient who has a potentially reversible cause with an acute infection, hypoxia. She has hyperactive symptoms with agitation, and she's showing new confusion and some paranoia, and family describes her as being intermittently attentive and able to stay awake in conversations. The ICU team is helping to treat the cause by treating the infection and using positive pressure ventilation. Now, is there more for us to do to help to treat the experience? Historically, this focus has been on antipsychotic medications. And let's talk more about the role for those and other medications. Broadly, let's think about when we want to use pharmacologic management. I'd like us to think about this by thinking about some of these key symptom domains that medications can target. agitation and hyperarousal, patients with disorganized thinking, with significant confusion, or particularly with paranoia or psychotic thought processes, hallucinations when they're seeing things that aren't there in the room, or severe sleep disturbance. And as we think about treating these symptoms, we're going to correlate them to some of the neurotransmitters we've talked about earlier when talking about delirium pathophysiology. So when we look at this array of the symptoms, all of them can be influenced by excess dopamine. Hence the reason why antipsychotics have so commonly been used in the treatment of delirium symptoms, and for hyperactive delirium in particular, where these symptoms are present. Looking at these symptoms, there's also a couple other neurotransmitters that can also be targeted to help treat symptoms. Agitation and hyperarousal are manifestations of overall sympathetic arousal that can be targeted by an alpha agonist, such as dexmedetomidine infusions in the ICU, or clonidine that can be given enterally or via a patch. Sleep disturbance, which is one of the prominent symptoms in delirium, has been shown to be related to circadian rhythm disturbance that happens with both as a cause of delirium and a consequence of delirium, with increasing research and some evidence of the role for melatonin in helping to treat this symptom. So as we continue to talk about delirium management, we're going to think about all of these neurotransmitters and the many ways we can think about helping our patients. We just talked about the role for antipsychotics in delirium. Let's talk a bit more about those medications. Both the first and second generation antipsychotic medications all provide anti-agitation benefits. This is primarily through their effect on dopamine. Haloperidol and risperidone both have very strong anti-dopaminergic effect, and that antagonism makes them particularly effective in that regard. When we look at the medications, there are some of them that have a greater effect for anxiolysis or sedation. This sedation effect is largely through a greater histamine effect that we see with chlorpromazine, olanzapine, and quetiapine. This also helps with anxiety by it being more sedating. For those second generation medications like olanzapine and quetiapine, this anxiety effect is also through a bit more effect on serotonin as well. What I want us to take away from this slide is that those with a strong dopamine effect, haloperidol and risperidone, don't have quite as much of that histamine effect as some of those others that'll give you more sedation, which at times you might not want if a patient wants to be awake and alert, but other times you may want for an agitated patient who you want to help calm and be able to rest. When we think about first-line treatments for delirium, there's a double-blind study of patients with AIDS and delirium. There was a randomized controlled study looking at haloperidol, chlorpromazine, and lorazepam, showing equal benefit for haloperidol and chlorpromazine. And what was notable is the study actually needed to be stopped early because of adverse effects with lorazepam. And minimal side effects were noted with either of the two antipsychotic medications. Now, why would it be that we have more adverse effects with lorazepam? Let's think about the effects of benzodiazepine medications. They affect many different domains, as you see here. With potentially reversible delirium, one particular concern is the amnestic effect of these medications, in which case we don't want to worsen confusion for our patients, and hence why they can be problematic in the treatment of reversible delirium. So, our takeaway message is that first-generation antipsychotics are effective medications to be used in delirium treatment. Do not use benzodiazepines, as they can increase confusion, disinhibition, And due to the muscle relaxation we saw in the previous slide, increase our fall risk in our patients, which is something we absolutely don't want to increase. Though, one note as a caveat to keep in mind is the role for these medications when needed in the treatment of alcohol or benzodiazepine withdrawal.
So Natalie has done a beautiful job highlighting the importance of thinking about antipsychotics to manage the patient's experience when they have an agitated delirium. To do this effectively, you and I need to remember to use the pharmacokinetics to manage the delirium as quickly as possible, but also safely. Remind ourselves of first-order kinetics, because each of these medications follows first-order kinetics. We start with a low dose. We offer a rescue or breakthrough dose every time to Tmax. And then when we start to get control, to move to maintenance, we catch up and offer a routine dose every half-life. Steady state will be achieved within 5 half-lives. And if we stop these medications, they will be eliminated in 5 half-lives. So to do this, we need to remind ourselves of the kinetics and go to the literature and look up the data. What's wonderful is the absorption is the same as for the opioids we've been talking about. Tmax is achieved intravenously within 15 minutes, subcutaneously within 30 minutes, orally and rectally within 60 minutes. But you'll notice the half-life is different. For haloperidol, the half-life is about 21 hours. For clobramazine, it's about 24 hours. And you and I are going to need to know the data for the other three antipsychotics if we choose to use them. Now, how are we going to do the dosing? Again, start low. Most of us like to start with a milligram of haloperidol, or if the agitation is more moderate, maybe 2 milligrams, and offer it once every time to Tmax. Subcutaneously, it would be every 30 minutes as needed. I like to make sure we move a little faster, so if my nursing colleagues have offered 3 doses and it's not working, I like to have them give me a call, and I will actually double the dose. I don't want to exceed 40 milligrams in 24 hours. And personally, if I'm using a lot and not getting control, I want some advice from colleagues in psychiatry or behavioral health. Once I have control, then I'm going to schedule all of the PRNs as a routine, offering it once or occasionally twice a day, and continue a breakthrough dosing schedule. If I was going to use clobramazine, because I want more sedation, or olanzapine or quetiapine, I would consider exactly the same approach. I've illustrated it here with clobramazine. 50 milligrams is approximately equal to 1 milligram of haloperidol. And you can see, again, as my dose gets up, I'm going to think about calling a psychiatry or behavioral health colleague, or do I really have the right choice of medications? I don't want to exceed 2,000 milligrams in 24 hours. So, what would be a reasonable dose? You might remember for nausea, it's very low dose for haloperidol. We rarely exceed 2 milligrams in 24 hours. For delirium, we tend to be between 2 and 10 milligrams, occasionally higher. And our colleagues working in psychiatry, when they're managing schizophrenia, often offer 5 to 50 milligrams, much more than you and I use on a routine basis for delirium. Well, are there any advantages to the second generation antipsychotics for the early control of symptoms? A lovely study showing that the answer is actually no real difference. Haloperidol compared to olanzapine, haloperidol compared to risperidone, had equal efficacy. So we've titrated to effect. Our patient is now settled. The question is, do we need a maintenance dose or not? Let's look at a case. Imagine the woman in front of you is 85 years of age. She was admitted because of a urinary tract infection. She had a fever and everybody was worried, so they brought her into the hospital. We treated her with ciprofloxacin. Initially, she had mild delirium with some confusion and agitation. Fortunately, 3 1-milligram intravenous doses of haloperidol in 1 hour, yes, the nurse delivered it quickly to try to get control. It settled the patient. She was able to sit up and eat lunch and communicate normally. The next day, we went to assess her. She didn't have a fever. There was no evidence of more confusion or agitation. Does she really need a routine dose of haloperidol? Absolutely not. We just left the order in place for breakthrough doses in case her symptoms returned. Again, reminding you why the half-life of haloperidol is 21 hours. We gave her 3 milligrams, and even after 1 day, she still got 1.5 milligrams inside her body. She's eliminated 1.5 milligrams, but she's still getting the effect. And fortunately, exactly as Natalie was explaining, we aim to treat the underlying cause, and it appears that it's being very effective. What about this alternate case? A 75-year-old gentleman presents with heart failure, atrial fibrillation, and very sadly, a major cerebral infarct. He's got moderate ongoing delirium and confusion and agitation, and you're consulted to help. You suggest haloperidol 2 milligrams because he's kind of moderate agitation. He takes 3 2-milligram doses. The nurses call you because it's not controlled. You offer 4 milligrams as a single dose, and the total of 10 milligrams settles him. Over the next days, everybody notes that the mild agitation continues intermittently. Everybody's feeling, oh my goodness, he really is going to need some maintenance haloperidol. And of course, different from the other lady, you know that you're not going to be able to reverse the effects of the cerebral infarct. So how do we do the dosing? Well, remind yourself, the half-life is 21 hours. So each day, half of the 10 milligrams that we initially gave him is gone. He's now only got 5 milligrams in his bloodstream. What do we need to give him to bring him back up to the same level? Don't we just need 5 milligrams? Absolutely. So the routine order, because the half-life is long, would be 5 milligrams every 24 hours. And of course, he could still always have that breakthrough dose of either 1 or 2 milligrams of haloperidol every hour, if it's oral, as needed. So there's a pearl here, isn't there? You and I should treat agitation the same way as we treat pain. Think of it as a breakthrough issue and offer a dose every time to T-max, PRN, or if the patient needs it. Now, we're titrating a little more rapidly here, so if 3 doses are not effective, let's have our nursing colleagues call us and we can double the dose. Effectively, we're doing a time-limited trial. We're waiting for T-max, we're looking at the outcome or the effect, and we're moving on if needed. The other is provide maintenance dosing once every half-life. Remember, you need to know the half-life, and in this case, the typical half-life of the antipsychotics is about 24 hours.
As Frank has just talked more with you about specifics of dosing the antipsychotic medications, let's talk a bit more about some of the adverse effects to consider to be able to use these medications in the most responsible way. As he noted, the dose range for antipsychotic medications is lower for a lot of our uses in palliative care than for some of the uses in psychiatry. Two of the biggest risks to think about are QTC prolongation, which we will talk about in more detail, and Parkinsonism, or some of the muscular effects from dopamine blockade. With some of the other side effects that can be noted, there's one that I want to highlight for us to keep in mind, particularly akathisia. It can commonly be described as a sensation of feeling like you have ants in your pants, that patients will describe as feeling very restless. Patients will describe feeling like they just can't sit still and they need to keep moving in some way. This is particularly notable when we think about treating delirium, where restlessness is one of the symptoms we sometimes target. Therefore, if you have a patient where almost everything else is getting better, but they still have this restlessness, keep akathisia in the back of your mind as a potential side effect that you may need to address. And noted here are some of the rarer but significant motor side effects that can happen, particularly with higher doses of antipsychotics, that we need to remember are a risk if they occur. Now, as we talk about risks of these adverse events, they vary a little bit based on the different antipsychotics and how they affect the neurotransmitters. The extrapyramidal effects, like Parkinsonism with more of a shuffling gait and stiffness, or a risk of having more of a dystonic reaction, which you would treat with something like an acute dose of Benadryl, IM or IV, happen more when there's a stronger dopamine blockade. We previously noted that haloperidol or risperidone both have some of the strongest D2 effect. And so your risk is highest with those medications. Your risk of sedation is highest with a stronger histaminergic effect. As you recall, earlier in this talk, we discussed how chlorpromazine, olanzapine, and quetiapine have stronger histamine blockade. Anticholinergic effects add to the sedation you get from chlorpromazine. And chlorpromazine has a higher risk of prolonged QT interval. And we're going to get into a little more about the QT interval and talk about that now. So, when it comes to QT risk, I don't know about you, but for me, sometimes my colleagues worry a lot about this when I talk about using antipsychotic medications with delirium. And I often like to remind them, we use a lot of medications in the broad category of medicine that prolong QTC. However, these antipsychotics sometimes scare others because people are less certain about how or why we're using them or where that risk-benefit ratio falls. That when we feel the benefit outweighs the risk, we feel comfortable saying we'll accept using medicines that could potentially prolong the QT interval. So it behooves us to remember for ourselves and for our colleagues what risks untreated delirium may have. There's the risk of morbidity and increased mortality, the risks of agitation and harm to the patient or staff, and then there's the risk of patients needing higher doses of sedation to manage agitation from delirium, which can prolong their hospitalization, even potentially lead to the need for higher respiratory support as those medications are increased to overcome the agitation that you see, and a need for restraints. So there's risk for potential harm to patients if we don't adequately treat the delirium. Now, as we think about QTC risk, you may wonder, is one antipsychotic better than another? Haloperidol PO and the atypical antipsychotics all carry similar risk around QT prolongation. Low-potency phenothiazines carry a greater risk, so chlorpromazine has a somewhat increased risk compared to some of the others that we've talked about as commonly used for delirium. The one that we note that's a little more of a risk concern is IV haloperidol. IV haloperidol is also very useful to us because it's the one of the few antipsychotics that's available to us in an IV formulation that can act quickly. So when I weigh the risks and benefits, there may still be benefits for using IV haloperidol, and I still often use it with patients. And one important fact to remember around the warnings is that we should not ignore them, but many of those warnings are based on data from case and event reports to the Food and Drug Administration versus our highest standard of clinical trials. And so I don't want us to forget about the value of IV haloperidol and how it can be used for our patients with delirium. So how do we approach this QT risk, and what additional testing should we use for patients? For those without a cardiac history or major risk factors, we can use the medications and obtain EKGs as clinically indicated, but we don't need to routinely obtain additional testing. Those with a significant cardiac history or other risk factors, I'd recommend that we get a baseline EKG and you monitor as needed. And consider other modifiable risk factors or other clinical situations that increase clinical risk for the patient that can influence your decision making. And as always, if you are the primary person caring for a hospice patient or a palliative care consultant in the hospital, collaborate with the rest of the team involved to balance the risks and benefits of helping to best treat that patient and help move their care forward towards the goals that they have. So you may be thinking to yourself, Natalie and Frank said there were other medications to treat delirium, and we just spent a lot of time talking about antipsychotics. So let's talk a little bit about those augmenting medications as well. Just as a frame, as we start to talk about them, I want us to remember the receptors we think about and the symptoms that we are targeting. The alpha agonists are going to target the hyperarousal and agitation that we see in patients. I think about a couple of ways in which we approach this. In one way, in the ICU, we can think about both treating agitation and from delirium, as well as helping in prevention by working with our ICU colleagues with the use of dexmedetomidine. The dexmedetomidine infusion can be very beneficial, though challenging at times, because in some hospitals, it's only available in the ICU setting. Fortunately, there are other alpha agonists available. And here we provide for you some examples of how to consider dosing clonidine or guanfacine to help a patient calm some of that sympathetic arousal so that they have less of a hyperstartle response that you see in some of your hyperactive delirious patients. Additional medication that has a lot of potential benefit for patients is melatonin. As we've discussed, the circadian rhythm gets disturbed in patients with delirium, and there's increasing thought that that disruption also propels the process of delirium forward. Therefore, adding melatonin can be a low-risk intervention that also provides benefit for the patient. We have here a dosing range and a target time to put it in the evening that tries to mimic some of the body's production of melatonin by dosing it a little bit before bedtime. The last medication I want to highlight is valproic acid, which can be helpful for the agitation we see in hyperactive delirium. There's two cases where I would like this to come to mind for you, is when you have a patient for whom antipsychotics are not adequately managing the agitation, or perhaps a patient where they have QT prolongation that genuinely limits the use of antipsychotic, even after you provide the education we recently discussed to your colleagues. Valproic acid works via targeting multiple neurotransmitters in the brain, as you can see here. And as we know, delirium affects all of these neurotransmitters. And thus, it has the potential to calm some of that agitation and be an anti-agitation treatment. as you dose it, I'd want you to consider thinking about a more conservative dosing for elderly patients, as we have noted here. And your monitoring should consider the common risks with valproic acid of thrombocytopenia, of hepatic injury, or pancreatitis. With these additional medications, hopefully it expands your toolbox a little bit to be able to think about treating your patients and additional ways to collaborate with your colleagues to help relieve patients' symptoms when they are struggling with delirium.
So Natalie has beautifully taken us through the pathophysiology and shared with us there are multiple different causes of delirium, many different neurotransmitters that may be in excess or reduced, and the story is complex. Historically, we've been managing delirium, the symptoms associated with it, in order to treat the experience with antipsychotics. More recently, we've added these other medications, including possibly melatonin and valproic acid. We said to you there hasn't been a randomized controlled trial until 2016 that was completed. Now I'd like to share the evidence from that trial. This is a beautifully constructed trial put forward by our colleagues in Australia, comparing the efficacy and safety of risperidone, haloperidol, against placebo. Which is more effective? They did a double-blinded, randomized controlled trial where they actually looked at placebo being the best of nursing care and using that non-pharmacological therapy that we've been talking about that even prevents the onset of delirium. It was conducted at 11 different sites, all of them either inpatient hospice or palliative care services across the country over 6 years, and they were able to accrue 247 participants. Wonderful. They actually got an even spread of the three arms. 82 patients got risperidone, 81 got haloperidol, and 84 received just the placebo treatment. The surprise was the patients who got placebo actually had reduced delirium symptom scores faster and further than those who got the two different medications. Not surprisingly, the patients who got risperidone or haloperidol had more extrapyramidal side effects. But truly worrying was the fact that although the patients who got risperidone had the same overall survival as those with placebo, the patients who received haloperidol didn't survive as long as those who got placebo. This has certainly stirred us all up and made us all really ask the question, are we making the best choices? So our group here in Columbus, Ohio, has thought about this very carefully. We recognize that the pathophysiology is complex. We recognize that we don't know everything about delirium. So we've come to the following as our strategy for managing patients with delirium, hoping that in the near future we'll learn more and more and be able to refine our strategy. Always treat the underlying cause as long as it's consistent with the goals of care of the patient and their situation is potentially reversible. Always instigate the best of nursing care and use those non-pharmacological therapies. Even teach family to come to the bedside and do some of this, because we know in our hospitals, our nurses are busy and may not be able to instigate all of these most effectively, particularly making sure patients have their eyeglasses, their hearing aids, the light levels are appropriate, that we use the right kind of music, and much more. And then, if the agitation is enough that we feel we want to start with medications, still, we are using low-dose antipsychotics, depending on whether we want a non-sedating or a sedating antipsychotic to settle down agitation if sedation's helpful, and titrate very carefully using the pharmacology we described. For severe agitation, where a patient's at risk of harming themselves, we've now started to use benzodiazepines to settle the patient and then make a decision, what will we use long-term to control any residual agitation? Hopefully, in most of our patients, treating the underlying cause actually settles the patient over time, and they're not going to need that much antipsychotic or other medication. But all of this is going to evolve over time, and what I'm hoping you will do is follow the literature closely along with us, and our strategies will improve as we learn more about the pathophysiology and appropriate treatments.
As we've talked a lot about medications, let's talk more about a specific setting, the intensive care unit. So, as we've talked about, delirium in the intensive care unit is common, with a prevalence at any given time of about 33% of patients, and incidence over the course of their ICU stay that can be as high as almost 90%. And despite the fact that, as you know, we have tools like the CAM-ICU to screen for delirium, it still remains underdiagnosed. As we think about partnering with our intensive care unit colleagues, there are a few things we want to have in mind. Many ICUs have specific delirium protocols with regard to which antipsychotics they use. They may also have restrictions about the use of benzodiazepines in the ICU, given increasing research about the role of benzodiazepines contributing to delirium. And a lot of the literature that's been coming out about delirium in the ICU has been showing no difference in time to resolution of delirium, length of stay, and mortality. That is creating questions in the ICU community about what is the best treatment. Along these lines, I want to talk about one of the most recent studies that looked at an ICU population with about 50% of the patients with delirium. As we look at this data, I want you all to note about 90% of the patients had hypoactive delirium. Patients were randomized to receive placebo, haloperidol, and ziprasidone. These doses of antipsychotics were up to fairly high doses of maximums of 10 milligrams of haloperidol BID twice a day or 20 milligrams of ziprasidone twice a day. This study showed no differences in any of their target measures related to the duration of delirium or mortality. Also showed no difference in adverse effects, such as extrapyramidal symptoms, which, as I look at this study, and as you look at this study, you may remember us talking about using antipsychotics to target a particular group of symptoms. Hypoactive delirium patients don't show that same degree of agitation, hyperarousal, that we might use the antipsychotics for. But we did see that high doses of antipsychotics did not create adverse effects, and thus this study confirmed for us relatively good safety of those medications in the ICU population. Looking at this study and other ICU studies, the Society of Critical Care Medicine guidelines have put forth some recommendations around treatment of delirium. They recommend against the routine use of antipsychotics. However, they do recognize a role for temporary use for acute agitation, distressing hallucinations, or delusional thoughts. And I name all of those specifically because that actually makes some sense for us if we think about how we've been talking about using antipsychotics. We want to use them for specific symptoms. We don't want to give them to every patient who presents with a symptom of delirium. We want to use them when we think the antipsychotic will help target a particular symptom while we are treating the underlying cause that's driving the delirium forward. So, along those lines, the ICU has also put forth some thoughts about how to manage patients and minimize risks of delirium, which will look familiar to you to some of what we've been talking about with regard to some non-pharmacologic measures. They talk about managing pain adequately, promoting spontaneous breathing trials such that patients remain intubated for only as long as absolutely necessary, because we've recognized that mobility and getting patients out of bed is beneficial for their recovery. They also specifically are thoughtful about analgesia and sedation medications, because as you have been thinking about, as you've been learning with us, medications are very significant factors in influencing mental status and delirium risk. They specifically note looking distinctly at delirium in patients, as well as some of those factors, like we noted, of mobility, exercise, and family involvement, as Frank was talking about how we use that in our assessments and or our strategies here in our hospice in Columbus, as our nurses provide some of that assistance, and families can complement that at the bedside, especially if you think about the ICU and what a busy setting that is. When a patient is severely agitated, I want us to think a little bit together about how to best and safely manage that patient. One of the ways to think of that is to think about how we potentially might be able to intervene and recognize early signs of escalation of agitation. As we think about what that might look like in a patient, we think about how our interventions can match by being able to more easily intervene at early stages with verbal interventions or voluntary medications, or the need to give emergency medications when a patient is aggressive or at risk of harm to self or to staff. When you have a patient at the top of that pyramid who's severely agitated and your intervention to prevent risk of harm to self or others is medication, I want us to think about it in a few ways. Number one, what is your goal with the medications you're going to choose? Settling the agitation, creating sedation or potential amnesia, and then thinking about some of the medications you could use individually or in combination. One of those combinations that's commonly used is haloperidol 5 milligrams, diphenhydramine 50 milligrams, and lorazepam 2 milligrams. You may see this combination commonly used in your hospital or have used it yourself. Emergency rooms often use it for the acutely agitated patient. The reason they put this combination together is that the haloperidol treats that agitation. When given intramuscularly, haloperidol has its highest risk of extrapyramidal side effects and a dystonic reaction in terms of a severe muscle contraction. So it's given with the diphenhydramine to prevent that reaction and give a little extra sedation. And it's given with the lorazepam 2 milligrams for the extra sedation for the patient, as well as some amnestic effect. Now, as we apply that to our medically complex palliative care patients who are potentially delirious, we want to think about those specific medications and how they would affect them. If we have a patient in the ICU with delirium who we really want to minimize additional risks of confusion, amnesia, worsened disorientation, your choice may be, and my choice likely would be, to say, let's give that patient haloperidol 5 milligrams and not give anything else in addition that would worsen their delirium. However, if you have a patient who has irreversible delirium at the end of life, who's severely agitated, not awake much of the time, whose family is watching them in severe distress, and the patient appears to be severely distressed, you may want to combine the haloperidol and the lorazepam to help that patient be able to calm, settle, and have the amnestic effect so they are not experiencing the suffering that you are trying to relieve at that phase in their disease and dying process. So, as you think about these medications and treating acute agitation, as we've been talking about all along, think about the effect of each of those medications and how they work, and how you can choose to use them in combination or individually to accomplish the particular goal that you have for that agitated patient. And once you can calm that acute agitation, you can then work on a longer-term strategy to manage the delirium moving forward to help hopefully prevent future episodes and the need to intervene at a point of crisis.
So since we started to talk about delirium management, we've been thinking about the situation where patients' delirium is potentially reversible. Now, let's transition and think about situations and how are we going to manage the patient when the context is irreversible. To remind you, we're talking about the patient who's potentially dying. We're talking about the situation where, based on the patient's choice of goals for life and goals of care, they don't want more treatment and investigations. Or the situation where we've really been trying to reverse the delirium and it's just not changing. And we've made a decision to say that the treatment hasn't successfully reversed the delirium, and now we need to focus on symptom management and getting the patient comfortable. So let's consider this situation, an 85-year-old man with end-stage heart failure and advanced renal failure, admitted to the hospice because of worsening pain, shortness of breath, and started on some routine morphine with relief. But over the last couple of days, there's been a change, and today he's breathing irregularly, there are audible secretions, the skin is cooling, there's actually visible modeling, and he's now restless and agitated, picking at the bed sheets and moaning. Maybe you've seen the story. And everybody at the bedside is distressed. Family's wondering if it's actually increased pain. So a little extra morphine was provided, but it didn't settle the patient. Actually got more agitated. So important that you and I, as healthcare providers, recognize the clear signs of the dying process. His change in level of consciousness, his altered breathing, the buildup of secretions, both of which really indicate brainstem dysfunction. This gentleman is dying. Not only this, but the cooling, the modeling, they're all part of the package. So in our module on last hours of living, we've already talked about the two roads to death. Fortunately, most of our patients go down what we would call the usual road, which is actually a hypoactive delirium. They lose consciousness, become comatose, and die effectively in their sleep. For some of our patients, they become quite hyperactive, agitated, restless. They may be experiencing hallucinations, mumbling, could even go on to have myoclonic jerks or seizures. But can you imagine that the patients down either path could actually be suffering? So let's first of all go down that hyperactive path. It's irreversible because they're showing signs of the dying process. We need to support the patient and the family, but instead of actually using an antipsychotic, thinking we might be able to reverse the situation, do we actually want to treat the experience through using either benzodiazepines, barbiturates, or propofol, with those as our backup? We reviewed this earlier. Benzodiazepines have significant actions. They're anti-agitation. They create sedation, very much create amnesia by inhibiting short-term memory, relax skeletal muscles, and they're very good anticonvulsants. Isn't that perfect for the patient who's now dying, may be having hallucinations, bad dreams, nightmares, probably doesn't want to remember the situation. They're phonating, and those are actually skeletal muscles that are closing, and as they exhale, we hear the moaning. And if they have intracranial disease, they're at risk for seizures. These are perfect medications to settle the patient who's dying. The antipsychotics don't do nearly this. They may get and help us with the agitation and provide a bit of sedation, but they're not amnestics and they don't relax skeletal muscles. And the one thing I do want to caution is never use opioids for sedating the patient at the end of life. The sedation that comes with opioids is an adverse effect and not what we want to use. To get to the dose where you'll get sedation, you may be at risk of being accused of hastening the patient's death, and you don't want to do that. Let's use the benzodiazepines. So, just like we did with haloperidol, I like to suggest we order 1 or 2 milligrams of lorazepam. We could offer it orally or place it against the buccal mucosa and give it once every 60 minutes until the patient settles. Just like we did with haloperidol, it could be every 30 minutes if subcutaneous or every 15 minutes if intravenous. And if 3 doses aren't effective, I like to encourage our nursing colleagues to give us a call and I'll double the dose of lorazepam. Clearly, once we've got control, we'll take the total dose and offer it every 12 hours, the half-life of lorazepam. Now, alternately, we could also offer midazolam. We could give a loading dose and then offer a maintenance dose.
We've spent a good bit of time talking about hyperactive delirium. And let's take a moment to talk about some of the specifics for hypoactive delirium management. Similar to our other pathways, we talk about potentially reversible and irreversible delirium in the management of hypoactive delirium. As we have for talking about hyperactive delirium, let's think about hypoactive delirium in the context of a case. In this case, we have an 83-year-old woman admitted to the intensive care unit with pneumonia. She's on a positive pressure ventilation with BiPAP, IV antibiotics, and is getting intermittent lorazepam to be able to tolerate the BiPAP. She appears more depressed to her family, less interactive, withdrawn. They note that she seems to be staring blankly at them and seems to somewhat drift off during conversations and not be as engaged as her usual self at home. Nurses also tell you that she's intermittently able to answer orientation questions and that she seems a bit confused. However, she's calm and not creating any disruptions in the intensive care unit. As you assess this patient, from all you've learned about delirium, you astutely recognize hypoactive features that are present in this patient. As we think about how to manage this patient, we're going to use the same framework that we always use: treating the cause, which we'll talk about in conjunction with the ICU team, who's hard at work on that, in treating her infection, providing her the respiratory support with the BiPAP. Looking at her medication list and trying to minimize medications that can contribute to delirium. And at this point, you probably astutely notice that the lorazepam that she's getting for anxiety could be contributing to her symptoms. So we'll want to try to minimize that as much as possible. And then we might want to consider low-dose antipsychotics. But in these hypoactive delirium patients who are already less interactive, more sedated appearing, we want to be very focused about how we use those medications, specifically if there are symptoms that we think the antidopamine effect will target. What would those be? Hallucinations, paranoia, perhaps some of the disorientation. And so you'll want to try at a low dose, and because you are all now very smart pharmacologists thinking about your medication choices, you're going to think about risperidone or haloperidol, which are more focused on that D2 receptor with less sedation than some of the other antipsychotics. And you'll try them at a low dose to see if they provide benefit and limit how far you escalate dose so that you don't add adverse effects for these patients. Now, let's think about another patient who we see. This gentleman has lung cancer with brain metastases who's unfortunately had progressive deterioration in the last 4 weeks. His performance status has declined severely, and he's showing signs of the dying process. He rarely opens his eyes. It's only occasional at this point. Speaking has decreased such that he's now only intermittently mumbling. His family has noticed some occasional smiles, but he's much less interactive with them. As you think about this patient, he now, as Frank had so nicely presented for us, is presenting with clear signs of the dying process, in which case he has an irreversible delirium. As we think about treating him, we think about what focus symptoms we want to treat. If he has non-distressing hallucinations, as you may have patients that you remember who have talked about seeing loved ones that they find comforting to them, we don't need to think about treating them. If he has distressing symptoms that we need to treat, we may think of treating his restlessness with this terminal, irreversible delirium with benzodiazepines. Or, as we noted for hypoactive delirium in general, if there's specific symptoms the antipsychotics would target, we would consider the role for a low-dose antipsychotic. Really, our takeaway for this hypoactive delirium is thinking specifically about whether antipsychotics have a role and thinking even lower doses than usual to treat in this particular type of patient. As we have worked our way through talking about delirium management, one more area of focus is the patients with dementia and Parkinson's disease. For these patients, the emphasis is even higher on focusing on non-pharmacologic management, given some of the complexity that comes into pharmacologic management. For this, it's some of what we've been talking about throughout, about the same management around hearing aids, glasses, sleep, familiar people and routines, and all of what you see here. And hopefully, some of what feels somewhat familiar at this point to you. When it comes to managing agitation in these patients, number one on the list is simplifying medications, as these patients are often at risk for very complex medication regimens, and our intervention may be pulling deliriogenic medications and simplifying that regimen. As you see here, there are a few other medications that you can specifically optimize and add in to consider. And one specific caveat to note for these patients, as we talk about our antipsychotics and delirium, is that for patients with Lewy body dementia and Parkinson's, they are at higher risk for those extrapyramidal effects and, of course, Parkinsonian side effects from the dopamine blockade that come with the antipsychotics. Therefore, those are patients for whom haloperidol is a greater concern that you want to avoid. And consider something with a lower dopamine blockade, such as quetiapine, at low, conservative doses to be carefully given to those patients, and whenever possible, in collaboration with their neurologist, to be able to best treat both their delirium and not exacerbate their movement disorder. Now, there's much more to be talked about at another time to get into depth about agitation in these patients. But this gives you a little bit to think about how to approach delirium in these patients who, of course, also have high risk of comorbid delirium. As Frank and I come back together, we want to pull back together with you to talk about a few of our key takeaway messages. The first is whenever you're seeing delirium or concern for delirium in your patient, you want to assess the situation and assess for potential reversibility.
And of course, once you know the situation and it's reversible, we need to use the best of medicine to treat the underlying cause as quickly as possible.
And while you're working at treating the cause, you want to implement those best non-pharmacologic practices and take a careful eye to that medication list and review what may need to be changed or minimized.
Now, if we have distressing symptoms, even while we're treating the cause, we We're going to choose the best of medications, be it an antipsychotic, use the melatonin, maybe it's valproic acid, or a different medication. And I want to be sure you use the pharmacokinetics to guide the dosing so you control the experience rapidly and safely. Bottom line?
It takes a team.
It sure does. Thanks for doing this together. Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.